Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, August 17th, 2025. The following program was previously broadcast June 1st, 2025. We open with a story from the New York Times, posted on May 20th, 2025, as part of the series 50 States, 50 Fixes. An Illinois building was a bird killer. A simple change made a world of difference. Chicago is one of the most dangerous cities in the United States for migrating birds, and a glassy lakefront conference center was especially lethal. By Katrin Einhorn. Photographs by Vincent Albin. The morning promised to be deadly. High above Chicago in the pre-dawn dark flew an airborne river of migratory birds. It was peak spring migration traffic in late April, and the tiny travelers were arriving at one of the most perilous points along their journey. These birds, inhabitants of forests and grasslands, do not perceive glass as solid and get confused by its reflections. Bright city lights seem to attract them, luring them into glassy canyons. The gleaming buildings of Chicago, curving along the shore of Lake Michigan, are especially lethal. A call went out to volunteers across the city. Be ready to hit the streets early to rescue the injured and document the dead. But at the building that has long been the city's most notorious bird killer, a sprawling lakefront conference venue that claimed almost 1,000 birds on a single day in October 2023, new protections were in place. The vast glass windows and doors of the building, called Lakeside Center at McCormick Place, are overlaid with a pattern of close, opaque dots. Applied last summer to help birds perceive the glass, the treatment's early results are nothing short of remarkable. During fall migration, deaths were down by about 95% when compared with the two previous autumns. Now, monitoring is underway during the first spring migration since the dots, with implications for glassy structures far beyond Chicago. Across North America, with Toronto an early leader, a growing number of bird-friendly policies and decisions by individual building managers are helping make cities safer for birds. On that recent morning, David Willard, an ornithologist at the Field Museum, set off on a lakefront path toward McCormick Place. Known as the Birdman to workers there, Dr. Willard has been tallying the building's avian victims for almost 50 years. It wasn't yet 6 a.m., and he wondered aloud about what he would find. As he walked, white-throated sparrows flitted around shrubs, a Baltimore oriole called from a tree, and a green heron flew by. The park seemed full of returning birds. If there were to be casualties at McCormick despite the treatment, Dr. Willard said, it would be on a morning like this. This is a good test, he said. The deadliest known building. Researchers have estimated that hundreds of millions of birds die hitting buildings every year in the United States. These strikes are believed to be one of the factors behind an almost 30% drop in North American birds since 1970. Chicago is one of the most dangerous cities in the country for migrating birds, according to research by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And no building was known to be more lethal than McCormick Place's Lakeside Center. Dr. Willard has been cataloging the dead there since 1978, when he was the Field Museum's collection manager for birds. He had heard that migrators sometimes ran into McCormick, and one morning before work, he decided to check it out. Below the glass were two dead birds. I sometimes wonder if I hadn't found anything, whether I would have ever gone back, Dr. Willard said. He started daily monitoring during migrations in 1982. From that year through 2024, he and colleagues have documented 41,789 birds killed by the glass at McCormick. Over the years, as the death toll mounted, advocates pushed for changes. McCormick managers said they tried a series of interventions. In the 1980s, strips of netting. In the 90s, bird of prey calls and silhouettes. They commissioned a 9-acre park of native prairie and woodlands on the roof of a lower parking deck, hoping it would draw birds away from the glass. Closing curtains during events, though, was a step too far. For us, our priority was making sure that our customers were satisfied, said Loretta Clark, chief executive of the Metropolitan Pier and Exposition Authority, the municipal corporation that owns McCormick Place. They rent space like this from us because of the view of the lake. Hundreds of birds continued to die each year during spring and fall migrations. Often it was a few each morning, but sometimes dozens in a day. Then, on October 5, 2023, Dr. Willard climbed the lakefront steps to the building's walkway on his routine inspection to find it littered with dead and injured birds. Shocked by the sheer volume, struggling to save the living while gathering the dead, he called a colleague for help. "They were continuing to crash as we were picking them up," Dr. Willard recalled. "The casualties were mostly warblers, but also thrushes, sparrows, and others. On the way back to the museum, they carried plastic bags bulging with roughly 975 dead birds." What can we do? As news of the episode ricocheted around the world, public outrage was unlike anything the managers at McCormick had seen. Calls and emails poured in. The American Bird Conservancy took out a full-page ad in the Chicago Tribune with a headline reading, "One Night, One Building, 1,000 Birds Dead." Ms. Clark said she reached out to the Field Museum, federal wildlife officials, and bird advocacy groups with a question, "What can we do so that this will never happen again?" Some of the earliest research on how to make glass safer for birds was conducted by Daniel Clem, Jr., an ornithologist at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. He found that falcon silhouettes were not effective. Birds did not register them as predators and simply flew into the adjacent glass. Instead, to effectively deter birds, the glass needed a pattern over its entire surface. A distance of no more than 2 inches would prevent even tiny hummingbirds from trying to dart through, he said. Eventually, Ms. Clark and her team decided on the dots. The treatment cost $1.2 million, paid for by the state of Illinois. Ms. Clark chose the pattern herself, and it was installed in a hectic 3-month period last summer to be in place for fall migration. "Visitors don't seem to even notice the dots from the inside," she said. She knows of no pushback. But one problem area remains, a transparent pedestrian bridge that was not treated. It's a tiny area compared with 2 football fields of dotted glass, but it now claims an outsized number of the victims. Of 45 bird deaths at McCormick last fall, 27 had struck the bridge. Managers at McCormick are still deciding whether to treat it. "We are waiting on some data," said Pat Allen, who oversees operations at the Metropolitan Pier and Exposition Authority. "We've got to justify what we're spending." Two different scenes. On the recent spring morning at McCormick, the sky still orange with sunrise, one bird lay dead under treated glass, a gray catbird. But Dr. Willard and I watched as dozens more flew toward the windows, and as they got close, seemed to put on the brakes, pulling up or veering away. My feeling is that in the past, those would have probably hit, and at least some portion of them died, Dr. Willard said. Walking around the Mammoth Building, there were no more casualties beneath the treated windows, but at the untreated glass of the pedestrian bridge, it was another story. 4 birds lay on the pavement, almost in a row, and Dr. Willard knelt to pick each one up. The dead went into a plastic bag. One, a white-throated sparrow, came around in his hands, trying to flutter away, and he carefully placed it in a paper bag to be released closer to the lake. Farther along, we came upon 3 more dead birds and another stunned one, all casualties of the untreated glass on the bridge. Two were bright yellow warblers called common yellowthroats, perhaps on their way back from Central America or the Caribbean. It was evidence that the bridge needs the film dots, too, Dr. Willard said. Word of the treatment's effectiveness is already traveling throughout the city and beyond. It started last fall when some of the results were coming out, said Paul Grolot, vice president of Feather Friendly, the company that manufactured the window dots. I had people emailing me directly saying, "We want what McCormick Place put on that building." Conservationists are using the building's success as they continue a long-time campaign to implement a bird-friendly design ordinance in Chicago. "I think that may win the day for us in City Hall," said Annette Prince, director of Chicago Bird Collision Monitors. "This is not just a maybe fix. This is going to make a significant difference in bird mortality, and McCormick Place is the poster child." And the ending of this story is a photograph, a common yellowthroat that was found near the Lakeside Center beneath the untreated glass of a pedestrian bridge, is being held in Dr. Willard's palm. It's so small that you can barely see it. The good news, it was only stunned and was later released. This article, part of the 50 States, 50 Fixes series by Katrin Einhorn, appeared May 20th, 2025 in the New York Times. From the February 2025 issue of Science News, "The Diorama Dilemma. Museum exhibit experts are tackling biased, wrong, or antiquated displays by reimagining, updating, or even dismantling them." At first glance, it's a simple scene. Six adult bison and a calf mill around a stream, but Matt Davis invites me to look closer. We're at the National History Museum of Los Angeles, where Davis is an exhibition developer. As he shows me, there is more to the diorama's tale than a handful of once-living, now taxidermied, bison skins. A well-worn path leads to the stream, and a bison skull sits to the side. This herd has been dropping by for some time, and they're contributing to the ecosystem. Perched atop that skull and scattered around the scene are birds that feast on bugs kicked up by the bison. Then Davis encourages me to step to the left. From here, I can peer into the trees on the display's far right to spot what only one bison has noticed. Two wolves lurk, eyeing their next meal. Dioramas, they have such rich stories, Davis says. I've been viewing dioramas since I was a young child, whizzing by them like many visitors do, so they seem like standard museum fare to me. But imagine, Davis says, seeing this scene when the museum's first diorama hall opened in 1925. There was no television yet. Technicolor movies had barely begun. National Geographic wouldn't publish a color photograph on its cover until 1959. For many city dwellers, the new dioramas were the only way to see animals as they might live. It would be like the most crazy virtual reality experience you can imagine, Davis says. People were totally blown away by this. Dioramas presented lifelike scenes in a manner that earlier museum exhibits did not. While museums once used skeletons and other specimens to emphasize the classification of animals and their evolutionary relationships, dioramas, characterized by rich backgrounds, detailed foregrounds, and a mix of taxidermied animals arranged as if they were alive and interacting, emphasized the nascent science of ecology in a way that spoke to viewers at an emotional level. Over the decades, though, dioramas have become dusty museum pieces themselves. These time capsules preserve the thinking of their time, including some biases that can be scientifically inaccurate, like an overemphasis on prize male specimens. And taxidermied still lifes must compete for attention in a multimedia world. Indeed, by 2000, many museums were wondering if they should toss their dioramas as old-fashioned space hogs that stretched the truth in the name of storytelling. The displays were considered dull or downright creepy by some museum visitors, Others criticized the echoes of an age when wealthy, white, male hunters grabbed fauna from native habitats to put on display. This diorama dilemma prompted some museums to reduce or remove displays. Others, recognizing the powerful hold that dioramas can still have on visitors, kept the displays in place. Nonetheless, modern sensibilities have forced a reckoning with dioramas' less than savory histories. In LA and elsewhere, curators and artists are experimenting with novel formats. At some institutions, curators are wrestling with challenges that come up when humans are depicted in offensive or blatantly racist manners. Sometimes, it turns out, no amount of effort can make historical dioramas fit the modern age. This reframing, it's the next step that needs to happen, says Aaron Smith, director of exhibitions at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. But it's not a diorama death knell. This awe and wonder aspect, that still exists. The dawn of dioramas. It's hard to pinpoint the very first dioramas, but during the 1780s, Philadelphia painter, naturalist, and taxidermist Charles Wilson Peale displayed specimens in what one visitor described as a romantic and amusing manner. In an exhibit area attached to his home, Peale erected an earthen mound with turf and trees, a thicket and artificial pond, and populated it with an array of lifelike specimens, from waterfowl and fish in the pond to birds in the trees and rattlesnakes, raccoons, and a tiger on the land. Later, natural history displays would be influenced by the evolution of other forms of popular entertainment. By 1800, some cities were opening panoramas, circular or lengthy paintings that provided an immersive experience. These spawned a variety of other oramas, such as georamas that displayed Earth's features on the inner surface of a giant hollow globe. Natural history museums broadly adopted the habitat diorama approach around the dawn of the 1900s. It is probably not a coincidence that dioramas became popular as a major change in biology was happening. The emergence of ecology, the study of how organisms interact with each other and their environment. Dioramas illustrate this concept in a way that individual specimens cannot. In the United States, Carl Akeley and other skilled taxidermists led the charge to create dioramas with three key features: real animal specimens grouped in lifelike poses, painted backdrops, and foregrounds with plants and rocks. These displays melded art and science in a new form of entertainment. This educational entertainment always contained a bit of a paradox. The taxidermists led hunting expeditions, shooting the most spectacular specimens, often of endangered species, to bring home and display to the public. And there is a photograph of taxidermist and big game hunter Carl Akeley, photographed in Ethiopia after he killed a leopard in 1896, reportedly with his bare hands, and he created some of the earliest museum dioramas. These hunter taxidermists, worried about extinction, saw their work as a means to preserve the last of disappearing species for future generations. But the trips were also a good time for big game hunters, whose fun was enabled by their relationship with museums. Today, this history of hunting and killing animals rubs some people the wrong way. A lot of this was boys with their toys, says Marjorie Schwartzer, author of Riches, Rivals, and Radicals, A History of Museums in the United States. These were baggers and taggers. These trips were genuine scientific expeditions, too. Researchers collected insects, plants, and other specimens. Many explorers, as I am delighted to learn, were women, such as the botanist Alice Eastwood, a curator at San Francisco's Cal Academy, and Akeley's wife, Delia. While the prime skins went into the glass cases, bones and other material entered the museum's research collections. Explorers also collected the scenery itself, taking photographs or lugging home paintings that were reproduced to set some dioramas in real, specific locales. The hope was these scenes would inspire viewers to want to conserve these charismatic species, though there's little direct research to confirm if this was the actual result. However, the fears of diorama designers that many species would soon exist solely in museums didn't always come to pass. Sometimes this was a direct result of efforts by the taxidermists themselves. For example, Akeley shot mountain gorillas in what was then the Belgian Congo on behalf of New York City's American Museum of Natural History, or AMNH. But he was so affected by the experience that he persuaded King Albert I of Belgium to establish Africa's first wildlife sanctuary, now called Virunga National Park. Today, the park, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, is home to around 350 endangered mountain gorillas. William Temple Hornaday, another of the early diorama makers, traveled to Montana in 1886 to collect bison for the Smithsonian Institution. Shocked by the rapid decline in their population, he became a conservationist and brought back live animals, too. These bison, initially displayed on the National Mall, became the first animals in the National Zoological Park, which was founded in Washington, D.C. in 1889. Rescuing dioramas. But 100 years later, museums were beginning to wonder if dioramas still had a place. Feminist scholar Donna Haraway, in 1989, decried a focus on virile male hunters and spectacular male specimens. In the face of multimedia and interactive exhibits, Willard Boyd, former director of the Field Museum in Chicago, has admitted that to some visitors, the Diorama Hall amounted to an unappealing dead zoo. In 2003, the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., removed its scenic dioramas in favor of a mammal hall that emphasizes evolution with animals displayed against minimalist backdrops. And during a rebuild in the early 2000s, the Cal Academy slashed its diorama collection, making room for new exhibits such as a four-story living rainforest. Other museums experimented with modernization, deploying interactive displays and animatronics. But those decisions weren't necessarily rooted in research on dioramas' educational or historical value. So the Oakland Museum of California, as it considered dumping its dioramas, commissioned Schwartzer and a curator to study the concept first. After a thorough analysis of 30 studies of more than 3,800 people viewing dioramas at 17 institutions, the pair in 2009 came up with a strong case for dioramas. It turns out that the displays are second only to dinosaurs in getting visitors to stop to view them. The dioramas did not change how people felt about conservation, though they did reinforce concerns people already had. They also sparked a range of emotional responses, including being creeped out by dead animals. But overall, most people love dioramas, the study found. Modern museum staff corroborate this anecdotally. I do walkthroughs all the time of the museum, and I can hear the "whoa," says Mariana Di Giacomo, natural history conservator for the Yale Peabody Museum in New Haven, Connecticut. The Peabody's oldest and largest dioramas illustrate Connecticut's coastal region and a forest edge. For many museums, dioramas have become something to preserve. New York City's AMNH began restoring its Bernard Family Hall of North American Mammals in 2011, reopening in 2012. Chicago's Field Museum, meanwhile, finished a diorama started by Akeley more than a century earlier. He'd mounted four striped hyenas shot during an 1896 expedition, but they never received the full scenic treatment. In 2015, the museum started a social media campaign to fund a completed diorama. In just 6 weeks, about 1,500 donors raised more than $150,000. It showed us that there is an enduring interest in these dioramas, says Gretchen Baker, the museum's exhibitions planning and operations director at the time. reframing dioramas. Back in Los Angeles, upstairs from the Placid Bison, I encounter a drastically different scene. The diorama, Special Species, pulses with changing light and psychedelic colors. No one has to tell me to stand still and drink this one in. It's part of the LA Museum's new exhibit, Reframing Dioramas, The Art of Preserving Wilderness, which opened in September 2024. The project aims to recognize dioramas for the historical artwork they are, while incorporating modern science and sensibilities. It's a hall on dioramas, not a hall of dioramas, Davis says. In Special Species, piñata-style sculptures depict at-risk California critters, including Chinook salmon and the desert tortoise, as fantastical Mexican creatures called alebrijes, as in the film Coco. Alhambra, California artist Jason Chang, who goes by RFX1, was on a team of three who created the diorama. Echoing the diorama designers of old, he hopes reviewers will walk away with an urgency to protect the environment. In The Ever-Changing Flow, video projections illustrate how the Los Angeles River evolved over centuries. A Peculiar Garden shows an eerie post-apocalyptic scene in which wildebeest sip from a polluted stream and amid metal-plated plants. Seattle artist Saul Becker explains that a garden is a very unnatural arrangement of nature. In other displays, Reframing Dioramas illustrates how dioramas came to be and inserts daring new scenes among more traditional ones. For instance, one shows a diorama in progress. Its backdrop is about 10% painted, and a table holds elements that would go into the scene. A fur, a sculpted body form, glass eyes, fake leaves, a few insects, and more. Another display features a camp-style tent and acknowledges the power imbalances at work when wealthy white hunters traveled to distant locales to extract specimens. Today, it notes, most large specimens the museum mounts died of natural causes and are acquired mainly from zoos or wildlife centers. Reframing is stepping outside of the way in which people view dioramas. Lori Bettison Varga, president and director of the Natural History Museums of Los Angeles County, says, "What are these really meant to do? How are they created? Why do we still have them? And then think, how can we think about humans' position in the environment differently?" Battling biases. There's plenty to reframe. Despite painstaking research by their creators, many classic dioramas are not entirely scientific. A lot of people have called them, in the past, bad science, because they personify animals, Schwartzer says. Many illustrate nuclear family groupings that in no way reflect animal lifestyles. Berenstain Bears aside, Papa Bear does not stick around to help raise the cubs. Papa Bear might eat a couple of the cubbies, Schwartzer tells me. Some exhibits misrepresent female animals, says Baker, now director of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh, as she shows me around the mammal hall. In the moose diorama, the female is standing in water, which allowed the designers to make her appear shorter than the male on land. And it's often females who lead animal groups, Baker notes. Homosexuality exists in nature too, she adds, but rarely makes an appearance in the diorama hall. In many cases, diorama designers probably wanted to show the different developmental stages of a species, says Mark Alvey, the Field Museum's academic communications manager. Groupings that look like stereotypical human families were instead a convenient way to exhibit adult males, adult females, and young. We always knew it was wrong, Davis says. Now we're slowly trying to fix some of those things. For example, the LA Museum has added more females to its lion pride over the years. The human element. Museum curators also acknowledge problems in how humans are or aren't depicted in dioramas. Some ignore humans completely, erasing the long-term presence of indigenous peoples, as well as the impacts of modern societies. Very little of the world exists in that virgin state. The kind of nature that dioramas exhibit, it's very unnatural, says Martha Marandino, a professor of biology education at the University of Sao Paulo. As part of this ongoing reframing, museums are beginning to acknowledge that missing human element. Some dioramas did, though, include hints of human presence. Peabody visitors, for example, see farms painted in the background of the two biggest displays. One also depicts a shell midden, a prehistoric trash pile left by indigenous people. AMNH faced a dilemma with its old New York display. Fashioned in 1939, it illustrates a fictitious 1660 meeting between Dutch leader Peter Stuyvesant and a delegation of the original stewards of the land that became Manhattan. Stereotypes riddle the display. Only men are in on the discussion, and they are shown in loincloths, not how they would have dressed for a diplomatic conference. The women, inaccurately relegated to the background, are topless with long, impractical skirts. Only Stuyvesant was identified by name. Rather than remove the diorama, the museum decided to keep it on display for now, to acknowledge and apologize for the harm done by the depiction. In 2018, curators added labels right on the glass to explain the various problems with the diorama and to name the leader. But sometimes reframing isn't possible. Take Lion Attacking a Dromedary. This Carnegie Natural History display showed a dark-skinned man on camelback under attack by the titular feline, a second lion below. It was never quite a diorama in the most traditional natural history sense, as it was always displayed with a detailed background and it lacked a foreground. The display, which contained a real human skull in the mannequin's head, had a long and meandering history. It was created by brothers Edouard and Jules Viraud, traveling collectors, taxidermists, and known grave robbers, for the 1867 Exposition Universelle in Paris, where it received a gold medal. AMNH then acquired it. That museum took the display down in 1898, reportedly because it was considered unscientific. One lion was male, but it's generally females who hunt. Worse, the man was garbed in an inaccurate mishmash of clothing that represents no specific culture. It's not educating anyone on anything that ever existed, says Aja Lance, a bioarchaeologist at Johns Hopkins University. Industrialist Andrew Carnegie bought it in 1899 for about $50 plus $45 shipping, equivalent to more than $3,000 today, for his new museum in Pittsburgh. In recent years, the museum has tried various forms of reframing. They covered the sides and erected warning signs so people who didn't want to view it could give it a pass. They added extra written material enumerating the problematic aspects. The Black Lives Matter movement and the 2020 murder of George Floyd brought all of its problems to the fore. This diorama was kind of like a poster child for all of these questions that were coming up at the moment, Baker says. It was kind of the symbol of a time in natural history museums when we would display the other, the exotic, the colonized. That summer, the museum covered the display completely. Finally, in the fall of 2023, after the museum's board of trustees voted to no longer display human remains, the diorama was permanently shuttered. It's now being dismantled. Using samples from two of the teeth, Lance and colleagues are trying to identify the geographic origin of the human remains and repatriate them. Lance expects to have preliminary results by April. But in many cases, wildlife dioramas, despite little inconsistencies, still serve their intended purpose, bringing striking nature scenes to museum-goers who might never see such animals in the wild. And they retain an old-fashioned power to inspire, wonder, and a love of nature. The ones museums keep around will continue to evolve and Davis hopes the Los Angeles exhibit lights the way. "We don't think this will be the last word on dioramas," he tells me. "We hope it's the first word." And the author of this article, Amber Dance, is a freelance science journalist based in the Los Angeles area. The Diorama Dilemma appears in the February 2025 issue of Science News. News from different scientific fields in the January 2025 issue of Science News. First, from Neuroscience, "Pregnancy Changes the Brain Forever" by Laura Sanders. Pregnancy overhauls a woman's body. The brain is no exception. A detailed study of a woman's brain before, during, and after pregnancy revealed sweeping neural changes, some of which persisted after her baby was born. The data set, published in the journal Nature Neuroscience, is the first comprehensive view of the neural changes that accompany gestation, a sort of what to expect when you're expecting for the brain. "The results of this case study are astonishing," says neuroscientist Claire McCormick of New York University Langone Health, who was not involved in the work. "Here we see, for the first time in humans, the extent of brain changes that are underway throughout pregnancy." This research joins a small number of studies aimed at understanding the female brain at various stages of life. Collectively, the work suggests that the process of becoming a mother, called matrescence, is another stage of development, like the brain overhaul that happens in adolescence. Earlier experiments mostly compared brains of women before and after pregnancy and inferred what happened in between. "There was a missing piece," McCormick says. "The 9 months of pregnancy was a black box, and we could only guess what that trajectory looks like." With 4 MRI scans before pregnancy, 15 scans during pregnancy, and 7 scans in the 2 years after the baby was born, the new study follows cognitive neuroscientist Liz Trestill of the University of California, Irvine, who realized she could be her own study subject. "Previous studies have found that the volume of gray matter in the brain, made largely of cell bodies, but not predominantly the message-moving tendrils, is smaller after pregnancy than before it. The new study confirms that finding and goes further, showing the sweeping magnitude of that reduction. Gray matter volume was reduced in about 80% of the places in Trestill's brain that the researchers study, shrinking on average by about 4% of its starting bulk. Gray matter is found primarily on the surface of the brain and in the spinal cord's core, and it contains neuron cell bodies and dendrites, and is responsible for processing and interpreting information. A shrinking brain sounds scary, but here it isn't, says study co-author Emily Jacobs, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of California in Santa Barbara. In a news briefing, she likened this process to Michelangelo chipping away excess marble to reveal David. Trestill was planning to undergo in vitro fertilization around the time that she and her colleagues began thinking about studying the brain throughout pregnancy. Over the course of her pregnancy and afterward, Trestill says she felt fine as her gray matter was reduced and refined, as the researchers expected. But another change to her brain surprised them all. Some of her brain's white matter tracts grew stronger, peaking in the second trimester. These tracts are bundles of information-sending fibers that travel around the brain, and the stronger they are, the more efficiently they can carry information. The primary function of white matter is to transmit information between different brain regions. By the end of Trestill's pregnancy, her white matter tracts had largely returned to their pre-pregnancy strength. "Some of the changes, such as gray matter reductions, seem to be permanent," says Susanna Carmona, a neuroscientist at the Instituto di Investigación Sanitaria Gregorio Marañón in Madrid. She and others have found evidence of these changes lasting years after pregnancy. It's highly probable that these are lifelong, she says. For now, the findings lead to more questions than answers. Trastel says, women's brains are woefully understudied. It's somewhat shocking that we know so little at this point, she says. With her many hours lying in a scanner, Trastel has done her part to push the science forward. And she's not ruling out more. I only have one child, she says, a 4.5-year-old boy who loves volcanoes and planets. If I have a second one, I'll get back in the scanner. Pregnancy changes the brain forever, in the January 2025 issue of Science News. Next, the health checkup. Cold relief may be in your head, by Laura Sanders. The viruses of cold and flu season are upon us and in us, where they're causing misery upon misery. But don't worry. You can hop online and for a mere $24.95, buy yourself a bottle of Zebo Relief pills, designed to ease your bothersome symptoms. The key ingredient? Absolutely nothing. They're placebos, and as such, they contain no active ingredients, not even sugar. The tagline, you are the active ingredient. Maybe you're rolling your eyes. Is there any reason to think the pills of nothing could work? Yes, it turns out. And in fact, many of us may have a similar placebo of sorts sitting in our medicine cabinets. And it's been on the market for decades. This decongestant is in over-the-counter cold medications sold by brands such as Sudafed PE and Dayquil. Yet in 2023, an advisory committee to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration combed through data on whether the drug, taken by mouth, worked and concluded it unstuffed people's noses no better than a placebo. Now the FDA is considering whether to pull this particular decongestant from store shelves. The scrutiny involves only the pill form of the drug. The nasal spray form, along with other types of decongestants, have no such baggage. Before you call your medicine cabinet, the issue raises some intrigue. In particular, the phrase, no better than a placebo. It's not necessarily that this decongestant doesn't make you feel better. It's that the placebo does, too. In a 2016 study, for instance, people took either the drug or a placebo, an inert substance that's generally thought to do nothing. Over the 7-day trial, both groups felt better by roughly the same amount. This highlights the power of expectation, says Michael Bernstein, an experimental psychologist at Brown University's Warren Alpert Medical School. Here you have a drug that people have taken for years, a drug that people really feel like works, he says. And it does work, just not in the way you might think. We usually expect a drug to work through some sort of fancy molecular action, a precise biological effect. But in this case, that effect comes from our beliefs. Neuroscientists don't have the placebo effect figured out, but they have some good ideas about how parts of the brain create expectations and beliefs. And those beliefs can hold power, even when we know we're taking a placebo. Bernstein and colleagues are working on a study right now that involves full honesty. After a visit to an emergency room, people who receive a prescription for an opioid pain drug are also given a placebo and told all about it. Our goal is to see whether or not the open placebo can reduce how many opioids they're taking after they get discharged from the ER, he says. That level of forthrightness might be a little too much to strive for if you're a parent of a kid with a nighttime cough, but a spoonful of medicine might bring relief. A 2014 study found that a child's cough responded equally well to colored flavored water and agave nectar, and both treatments beat nothing. Knowingly using a placebo to treat cold symptoms in young children may constitute good medicine, the authors of an accompanying editorial wrote. Many parents already dole out placebos without even knowing it. If your kid has ever gotten a scrape or a cut, you said, I'll kiss it to make it better. That's basically just a placebo, Bernstein says. As you consider phenylephrine's role in your life, take a moment to consider that your mind might be a powerful ally in your fight against your cold, even if it knows full well what you're trying to slip past it. A placebo won't work for every condition, nor will it help everyone, as this one-star review of the Zeebo pills makes clear. Totally doesn't work. But before you make up your mind, consider this four-star review. It does what it's supposed to do, whatever you think that might be. And this Health Checkup Cold Relief May Be in Your Head by Laura Sanders is part of the news summaries that appear in the Science News issue January 2025. And now we turn to the first of two New York Times trilobites. First, how bats enjoy an in-flight beverage service. Bats are not only masters of aerodynamic flight, they're skillful at multitasking while flying, too. Posted on April 22, 2025, and written by Rachel Neuer. Some humans like to think of themselves as good multitaskers, but bats may do it better. Many bat species have the ability to fly while simultaneously drinking water. But unlike people who try similar multitasking, such as driving while texting, the bats never crash. Now, new research reveals the physics behind this feat of coordination. The technical details of how bats do this are very complex, but what we're ultimately trying to understand is how animals multitask, said Sung-Hwan Jung, a biophysicist at Cornell University and an author of the study published in the Journal of the Royal Society Interface. Animals have very busy lives like humans, and if they can do two tasks at the same time, they have a better chance at survival. Of the world's approximately 1,400 bat species, skim drinking on the wing is the most prevalent strategy for taking a sip of water, said Rolf Mueller, a mechanical engineer at Virginia Tech and an author of the study. This behavior likely evolved to keep bats off the ground and away from predators. Although finding water is a necessity, sources of water can be dangerous places for animals, Dr. Jung said. Some bats drink directly by lapping water with their tongues as they fly over a water source. Others, such as flying foxes, drink indirectly by wetting their fur and then licking it, a strategy known as belly dipping. The new study focused on the tongue lappers only. Two Pratt's round-leaf bats, which live around Asia, and four greater horseshoe bats common in Europe, Africa, and Asia, both of which are insectivorous species. In a laboratory enclosure large enough for the bats to fly around in, the researchers deprived the animals of water for 6 hours and then introduced a drinking source. They positioned several cameras at different angles near the water and used stereoscopic imaging to track specific points on the bats' bodies as they swooped down to drink. They combined data for the different cameras to produce a 3D rendering of the bats as they moved through the space. Like humans who tend to slow down when multitasking, the researchers found that the bats reduced their flight speed as they approached the water. They suspect this may be partly a result of the challenge of performing two tasks simultaneously, as well as because of the physical constraints of flying so close to the water's surface. To avoid touching the water with their wings, the bats lessened the scope of their wing stroke by about half. They also used a higher angle flapping motion to counterbalance the drag caused by their heads leaning down. At the same time, the bats precisely controlled their tongues as they delicately scooped water into their mouths. Precision is key, Dr. Jung said, to keep a splash of water out of the bats' noses. Bats navigate using echolocation, which entails emitting a high-frequency sound and then using the bounce back of the sound waves to gather information about objects in the environment. Counterintuitively, though, Some bat species emit echolocation calls through their nostrils rather than their mouths. So getting water up their noses would effectively cause them to go temporarily blind. Ulmar Graffa, a biologist at Universiti Brunei Darussalam, who specializes in bats and was not involved in the study, said the paper is impressive. Drinking on the wing has not received the necessary attention because it is very hard to get bats to perform this behavior in the lab, he said. While the study involved a small number of bats of two species, he said it reveals the remarkable ability and complexity of bat flight maneuvers. Kenny Breuer, an engineer at Brown University who was not involved in the research, added that the study is a wonderful combination of detailed observations, careful characterization, and rigorous modeling of some of nature's most impressive flyers. Dr. Jung and his colleagues plan to carry out further studies of other animals' multitasking behaviors, from swallows that glide across the surface of water to drink, to dragonflies that perform aerobatic mating contortions mid-flight. The findings that come out of such studies could also inform bio-inspired flying robots, Dr. Jung added, something he and his colleagues are already working on. The entire approach that the authors have taken highlights the unexpected benefits that we can find from this kind of basic scientific research for improving our understanding of the environment and inspiring new engineering designs, Dr. Breuer said. This New York Times trilobite, How Bats Enjoy an In-Flight Beverage Service, was posted on April 22, 2025. Our second New York Times trilobite, posted on May 1, 2025, we learn about Ronan the sea lion, who is probably better than you at keeping a beat. As she has aged, the pinniped's rhythmic abilities have only improved. By Gennaro Tomma. This is Ronan. She's a California sea lion, and she probably has better rhythm than you. Scientists earlier showed that Ronan, a resident of the Long Marine Laboratory at the University of California, Santa Cruz, was the first non-human mammal who could be trained to keep a beat, including moving in time with music. That was in 2013, when Ronan was young. Researchers recently decided to test the 15-year-old sea lion's skills again and showed that not only had she improved her ability to bob her head in sync with beats, but she is even better than most humans at doing so. I think that it demonstrates conclusively that humans are not the only mammals able to keep a beat, said Tecumseh Fitch, a cognitive biologist who studies biomusicology at the University of Vienna, and wasn't involved in the new study, which was published last Thursday in the journal Scientific Reports. Parrots are known to be able to keep a beat by moving their bodies, and recently studies have highlighted the beat-keeping capabilities of other mammals, such as monkeys and rats. But after more than a decade, Ronan the sea lion's rhythmic entrainment is clearly the best known in non-human vertebrates, Dr. Fitch said. The researchers trained Ronan for a few months, focusing on enhancing her precision with the old tempos on which she was trained in the past. Then they looked at how good Ronan was at keeping the beat compared with when she was 3 years old, showing that she improved her skills as she matured. Then the team tested Ronan's ability to move her head in time with tempos of 112, 120, and 128 beats per minute, and compared it with the ability of 10 people aged 18 to 23 to move their arm in time with those same tempos. The hand is like the sea lion's head, and the arm is like the sea lion's neck, and it's about the same size, so they can move through the same amount of space and do the task, said Peter Cook, a cognitive neuroscientist with a specialization in marine mammals at New College of Florida. In every parameter that Dr. Cook and his colleagues tested, Ronan was head of the class. There was no human that was better than Ronan on every measure of precision and consistency, says Dr. Cook, and she was better than most humans on all measures, so she really rose to the top. Back in 2013, Ronan's head-banging ability sparked a scientific debate over whether what she was doing could really be compared with humans' rhythmic skills, and whether this behavior might be widespread in the animal world or restricted to species capable of learning complex vocalizations by hearing them. That includes humans and parrots, which are able to spontaneously keep a beat. What Ronan is doing, I would say, really looks indistinguishable from what humans were pretty good at doing, Dr. Cook said. He also believes that the new data on Ronan's ability further challenges the idea that the ability to move in time with a rhythm is unique to vocal learners. Other scientists disagree with this conclusion. Anirudh D. Patel, a cognitive neuroscientist at Tufts University, said he was sticking with the hypothesis that such ability to move in time to music spontaneously is unique only to certain species that can learn complex vocalizations naturally. He says further studies should investigate the vocal learning abilities of sea lions, which would confirm the hypothesis. Even so, he points out that a very important difference is that Ronan learned to keep a beat with training, which humans and parrots don't need. As a next step, Dr. Cook and his colleagues plan to investigate whether Ronan can move in time with beats that are more unpredictable. Can she do things that accelerate or decelerate? Can she do patterns that aren't even steady in time but change? Dr. Cook said. These are things humans can be quite good at. Can a non-human do those? And this New York Times trilobite about Ronan the sea lion, who is probably better than you at keeping a beat, was posted on May 1st, 2025. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.